Hey everyone, welcome. Training call number 7. You got your handouts? Show me your handouts. Yes, yes. Great. Okay. So before we dive into this theory, what I'd love for everyone to do, and actually this is on the first page, researching your resources. Remember that from lab one? Weeks ago, months ago? Take a second to tune in, and there's some prompts there. What were they at the start of the program? Do you remember? As I wrap up in a blanket here, there's one hint. Staying warm. Hot tea. Yep. Cheers, Leah. Ruth. Who else has hot tea? So what were they at the beginning? Are they still your favorite resources? How have they shifted? And yeah, feel free at this moment to put some stuff in the chat. Sunshine, someone said. Yeah, sunshine is a big resource for me too. Doesn't have to be direct sun. It can even be a cloudy day. There's still, right? There's still lots of light on a cloudy day. The Bible, yeah. For some of us, our connection to source, connection to books. Some of us, I know, love fiction. I'm not a big fiction lover. I wish I were. I try to get into fiction. There's maybe a handful of fiction books that I've really gotten into. Ocean, yeah. The ocean's near me. Warm water bottles, calling a friend, touch, trees. Someone said, I realize how important a resource and the accountability of these weekly calls with Seth and Irene are. Yeah, there is something about, we don't say having to show up because it's your choice to show up, but there is something about some consistency. You know, someone did say the Bible. A lot of people, that's a consistent thing to go to church, to go to a service. You know, it's a routine where you are still and connected and listening and being with others. Birds, potent posture is becoming a great resource. Ah, there, I just fixed mine. I was too far forward. Yeah. So I'll ask that question. What out of the lessons you've been doing, the neurosensory exercises, are either becoming a spontaneous resource, or how are you going back to the old lessons and using them auditorily, listening to them to connect and to drop in, to resource? What are starting to be more spontaneous? So just think of this for your own being right now, but also see what other people have to say. The self-hold, that connection, the hug. The reason I don't call it hug, why do you think? There's often some negative connotations around hugs. So that's why I call it the self-hold. You're giving yourself hold. Feeling the butt on the ground, dropping into my body sensations. I'm having a really big deja vu right now. I thought I'd share that. So we're all supposed to be here right now. All the senses when driving. Yeah, what a better way to stay really in tune with the present moment when you're driving. So important. Orienting has become a default. That's great. When orienting becomes a default, what that means is you are more in tune with the environment, especially when you're orienting in an exploratory way, right? You're actually, I'm in my world. I'm in this world. I'm aware of the world now. The layers lesson, who remembers that? Connecting with the skin, the muscle, the bone, the fascia. The joint and containment exercises, Brainstem, slowing down. That's a good resource. Never thought of that one, but yeah, pausing, slowing down, waiting. There's another potent posture. Kidney adrenals are my allies right now. That's a good way of looking at it. Rather than being your source of stress, how can they be an ally to actually bring you into more presence? More physical resourcing, touch, having more love for myself. Yeah, it's hard to do that when we're in survival stress. A lot of people throw out self-love, you got to love yourself more, but it's really hard because what is that love piece? It's ventral vagal. It's using the higher part of the parasympathetic, that ventral vagal part of the parasympathetic. You need more of your brain power for that, less survival. So to have more love means you're in less survival stress. Make sense? That's also how we have empathy. You can't have full empathy when you're in deep, deep, deep survival stress. You might cognitively have the actions. Oh, when I see people, I'm supposed to shake their hand or I'm supposed to nod. These are the behaviors I'm supposed to do when I'm with another human or I meet another human. But the actual feeling of it internally is very different. When it's natural, it's because you're not in survival stress. Making sounds, yeah, the vu-ahs, those can be also great. So much stuff, thank you. We've already covered all these pieces. So my main questions were, what were your resources at the start? How have they shifted? Are any of the neurosensory exercises becoming resources? Which ones? And any non-SBSM related resources surfacing? So that'll be the final question is, are there anything starting to pop up that isn't SBSM related, but is super new? Are you doing something differently? Has anybody started becoming a bit more active, getting out for walks more, starting to do different kinds of self-care? Are you cooking differently? Are you reaching out differently? So yes, dancing more and more, socializing, stronger boundaries. That's a good resource. Nice. Saying no more often. Yeah, all signs of healthy aggression, protection of self, less emotional eating. Yes. Taking Qigong from Ilya. Great. He's a great Qigong teacher. I do his movements every morning. Eating better. Speaking out the uncomfortable truth. Yes. Telling the truth is very important. Very important. Even if only to yourself, right? I'm back to riding my horses after an accident in January. Great. Started to crochet and bake. So more creative hobbies, yeah? Authenticity. All right, thank you, everyone. I'm changing my wardrobe. That's cool. Is anybody finding that your clothing is changing? I certainly can't wear tight clothing anymore. Can't do it. Can't wear a belt. Can't wear anything that pinches. For the ladies, you might find that wearing a bra becomes really, really challenging as you start having more desire to have spaciousness in your chest and in your lungs. Has anybody found that their clothes sizes have changed? The alumni might be more familiar with this as you gain more capacity and there's less freeze in the ribs. This is a true thing. In the diaphragm and the pelvis, your bones will get bigger. There's less constriction. So if you find that things aren't fitting you, it's not necessarily that you've gained body fat. It's that your structure is actually changing. Your pelvis might get bigger. Yeah, shoulders are wider. Yes. Every single piece of clothing I had 10 years ago is gone. Can't fit into anything, even a couple years ago. So again, don't be alarmed if that happens. It's just showing how much more space you have in your organs, for your organs, I should say. You can breathe deeper because there's more expansion. Hips are wider. Yeah, someone said, I've gone up a size. Your feet might change, right? You're not as tense. When you're tense in your feet, your bones get crushed a little bit because the fascia is so tight. So as you start to relax, as you start to not grip when you stand, because you're finding that potent posture, this is true, your bones will relax in your feet. So don't be surprised if you have to change your shoes too. It could become expensive, but just a little warning there. All right, thanks everyone. Yes, voice has changed too. Your voice will change. If you go back to my earlier vlogs, you'll hear my voice is much higher. It's almost hard for me to listen to my voice from 7 years ago because you can tell that there isn't as much space to resonate in the chest, right? When you go into a room and you say something, it has that resonation, it echoes, that those big spaces, that's what's occurring when you have more space in your chest cavity, in your lungs. Hearing has improved, yes. All the senses, isn't it interesting when we're not in as much survival stress? It's revolutionary. Okay, thanks everyone. So just a reminder again, as we get into the call and the theory, to keep the chat quiet-ish. And if there is a dying, burning question around what I'm talking about, Leah is here to answer those things or to direct you to another resource. And if you have a big question, ask it in the general question thread in the course site. All right, first quote here from Peter. Read along with me if you wish. The antidote for trauma is to create new experiences in the body that contradict helplessness and collapse. We could just end the call today and that would be enough. I won't. But what did I just talk about space in the body, finding the potent posture, having depth and feeling in the belly, resonating, ooh, the voos, the ahs, yeah, the touch, feeling sensation. When you're in collapse and helplessness, you can't sense those things in the same way. They're muted. So what's sort of different about what we do here in SPSM is I am not asking you, as you have seen, we're not asking you in the lessons, what was your biggest trauma? List all your traumas, list all the bad things that happened to you, all the surgeries. And we're not doing that. We're reverse engineering the system. If you haven't really sunk into that reality, what we're doing is we're making the system more robust and whole. We're going into the opposite of helplessness and collapse. And then by doing that, the system starts to shift and it starts to change. And so this is kind of that antidote, if you will. We're providing it with different formulations, different situations. So I'm going to share a story. So as you can see, if you just flip through pages 2 and 3, we're going to touch a little bit into anger and healthy aggression. We're going to talk a little bit about other primal emotions, such as shame, toxic shame, which is a hot one. It's a tricky one and a sticky one. Going to read some stuff. And we're going to talk about these imprints of shame from a somatic perspective. But before we do that, I'm going to talk about a story. So the first line there underneath the quote, here's an example of working with an emotion or quality of human experience that is not anger-based, but can lead to the accessing of anger, I'll say it again. So while we've already done two big calls on anger and healthy aggression, we're bringing it back because it's an important one. And the story I'm going to share, it's my personal share and epiphany exploring the quality of the emotion of horror. It's a hard one to say for me, horror. And that is what it is. It is something that is horrific, something that is really intense, something that is shocking. And so for some of you, so this is a bit of a story. So you relax, sit back, grab some tea. I'm going to grab tea too. The alumni know this story, so this will be old news for you. I see someone saying, yep. Some of you know this, some of you don't. I was literally raised in an animal hospital. My parents are both veterinarians, small animal, dogs and cats, the occasional rabbit and bird, reptile. And I grew up literally, the first practice that my parents had was in our basement of our house. And I remember my mom telling me when I was old enough to walk, walking downstairs, and all these people were in the basement. And I looked up and said, who are all these people, mommy? Like just strangers, sea of strangers in our basement. And apparently, and I don't know how true this is, urban legend, but there were so many cars parked down our suburban street that I think the cops got called once because they weren't sure what was going on in our house. So my parents were very good veterinarians. And then as soon as they had a private practice that was outside of the house, I pretty much lived there before I went to school, and then school got out and I would always come to the clinic. I had a desk in the clinic where I could do my homework, but I also did things in there. I helped with cleaning, which is where I got a lot of my chemical trauma, which some of you know about. I developed x-rays. I counted the cash out at the day end. I cleaned. I greeted customers or clients. I answered the phones. I did all these things. By the time I was 14, I could run that practice. So the story connects with that. So now fast forward to 2009, I'm in my somatic experiencing training. And we're doing what's called a triad, which is where you're in three group or a group of three people. And the topic of the day, and I can even feel my heart rate go up a little tiny bit as I talk about this, was horror. And my instructor at the time, Steve Hoskinson, who was one of Peter Levine's proteges at the time, he's like, so you're going to talk about horror. And I just was like, what? What do you mean we're going to talk about horror? Bring up something that was horrific in your life. Right. And so these are the things that you would play with in these trainings. You might work with anger. You might work with sadness. You might work with joy. And so today was horror. So I'm sitting with my peers and our assistant. We're outside on a beautiful deck out looking the ocean, California ocean, Carlsbad, if those of you who know Southern California. And I'm like, horror. And so I'm just sitting there. I'm like, okay, I'll be a good sport. I'll pretend that there's something horrific in my life to find. And I sat there and I was just in my body. I'm doing all the things you've been learning. I'm orienting, feeling my ground, like with good people, safe. Horror. I'm literally like, I'm repeating it almost like a mantra in my brain, not in an obsessive way, but just let's do this. Little did I know. So as I started to feel into it, my arms started to do this movement. And one of the things you're learning in SBSM is to track movement, this procedural memory. Remember this from Biology of Stress video number 5? These procedural memories that are old. I always give the example of protecting yourself from a ball, you know, that might have hit you when you were a kid, and oh, you're feeling it now. So I am like, oh, there's a movement. I could feel my shoulders lifting. I could feel my arms lifting. And I'm, you know, trained in movement. So I'm listening, I'm feeling, and I'm turning my spine. I'm gonna stand up and I'm like this. I'm like this. Do that again for those who didn't see. I'm like this, right? Like. And then as soon as I I don't know if it was what I felt in my feet or what I felt in my arms or if it was all the pieces put together. I had the somatic memory of holding all the animals that I had held as they were being either put under for surgery or what happens in veterinary clinics, euthanized. I probably held thousands of cats and dogs over the years while they were being put under for surgery, routine surgery, right? Or being, you know, euthanized because they're really sick, right? And in that moment, there was this flood of every single crazy emotion, anger, deep sadness, grief, disbelief, holy shit energy. How come I haven't thought of this ever? Anger towards my parents, even though I'm not angry at them now. It's like my parents were both raised on farms. What do kids do when you're raised on a farm? You help with the farm. You do all the things, right? So for them, I was just helping with the farm, but the farm was a little too advanced for an 8-year-old, for a 7-year-old, for a 10-year-old, and so what occurred in that moment was, first of all, I could see the shock in my partner's eyes. My assistant, as skilled as she was not expecting that. So for those out there who are therapists, sometimes your clients will tell you something and you may have a face that they probably shouldn't see. So this is where it's so important if you're doing this work with people, you have to be able to not freak out when you hear the most intense things. So I'm like, whoa, this is a big one. Wow, this was my life for almost 15 years. And to this day, I can feel what it's like when you're holding a living thing and all the life comes out of them, right? It's a very visceral sense. What's interesting is that I also grew up having lots of surgeries on myself, as is more commonly known, anesthesias. And so we know that when someone goes under, it is a near-death experience. Surgery is actually a very serious thing. It can be very useful, but it also is serious business. You are literally dying. You might be going under for a very good reason, and for the most part, it's quite fine and you come out, but you need to do some aftercare to come back to earth after you do something like a surgery, even if it's a general, even if it's mild sedation for a tooth extraction, right? You have been transported a little bit. So I share this story because some of you might not yet have tapped into your anger and healthy aggression. And it might not be something that needs to be rushed. And it might be that it comes out with a story or a memory that you don't think is connected to anger and healthy aggression. If someone were to have said to me theoretically, hey, Irene, what did you do as a kid at the vet clinic? I can guarantee you, I wouldn't have talked about that thing, holding animals as they were being put under and put down. I would have talked about the cleaning, answering phones, as I just told you, cleaning ears. The worst part was cleaning the kennels, in my opinion, because they were pretty gross. Flea baths were one of the worst, trying to bath a cat that has fleas, not fun, right? So what I'm saying is it's not about hiding, but we will keep certain things away from our system until we have the support and capacity for them to come out. And thank God I had this thing come out when I was sitting with two other really solid humans and an assistant, and I was in an SE training. So this is one very interesting story of how we can keep things in us that we don't realize are really traumatic. People thought it was great that I worked at an animal hospital. That must have been so fun, Irene, as a little kid. And I would say nothing. I'd be like, I wouldn't say anything when relatives and friends of the family would say that. It's like, yeah, there's some cute puppies and kittens that we get to play with, which did happen. But why do animals go to an animal hospital? They're sick, right? Except for the routine stuff. So it's an intense story, but I share it also because don't underestimate some of the things that may have occurred when you were young that just seemed like no big deal, but were really a big deal, especially when you're like 6 years old or 4 years old, or even a teenager and you've never seen anything intense, right? Even being in a room and you're there and grandma or grandpa is passing. That's intense for a little person if they haven't been prepared for what death is. And we just don't tend to do that in our culture, right? At least Western culture. It is changing, but slowly. So as I finish up that story, I will let you know that it led me into opening up the chemical trauma that was stored in my system, because I was in freeze around that entire world of working at that animal hospital. And so the layers that started to peel off from that took time, right? It took time, years and years, a decade plus, to work through some of those deep chemical pieces. Because think about this. So again, we'll go a little bit deeper. I didn't realize I was going into freeze, because you don't when you're in it, especially when you're a kid. Now you guys as adults should start to notice when you're going into a bit of a freezy response. Is anybody starting to notice that with more awareness? It's easy to know when you're going into sympathetic because your heart starts to pound. Freeze, if you're so used to it, you might be like, I'm just a little tired. Oh, okay. I'm feeling a little disoriented. This is freeze. But when you're 12, when you're 10, you don't get it. And so what was occurring was, as I was being exposed to all these chemicals, toxic, deadly chemicals, true story, tick and flea powder is very toxic. If you use that stuff, make sure it's not, well, we put it on our animals, but if you can avoid it, it actually gets into our DNA, I've heard. So I was inhaling that stuff weekly, right? So these chemicals are coming in. My system is in freeze. My system can't detoxify that if I'm in freeze. So this is why I stored so much of this stuff. So if you are a kid that maybe was raised on a farm, some are back in the day, all the pesticides that might have been used, if you worked in department stores with all of the scents and smells when you were a teenager and you were in freeze, there's another, all the chemicals we put on ourselves as kids. And there's just lots of potential to start to piece together how we store this stuff in relationship to our freeze responses growing up. So I'm just sharing that because I know more and more folks are interested in getting these chemicals out of their body. And sometimes it doesn't work until you start to come out of survival stress. The system just won't know how to get this stuff out. So this stuff goes really hand in hand with a lot of the other holistic healthcare practices that are becoming more popular. All right, everyone, come back to your seat if you have left it. I'm gonna have a little tea. Have a little pause and we'll get into page two. And I never confronted my mom and dad about this. It wasn't important, right? They really didn't do anything wrong. They just didn't know, right? And if my parents, they're still alive, but if they had passed, there's no way for me to tell them. But I made peace with it in the way that I did, just knowing that they weren't doing it maliciously. And working at that animal hospital taught me a lot too, right? Taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about health, and I can do minor surgery and I understand pharmaceuticals, and I also can connect with a lot of different mammals and know their needs, right? Know their needs. That's the other thing that I forgot to say. When you are holding these animals, they're frightened. And so I got really good at knowing how to settle and soothe them while also holding them really still. And Seth can attest to this. When we had cats and we had to, I think, give one of our cats drops or something, I could do it with one hand. Like I knew exactly how to do it. And he just watched me and he tried and I was like, give the cat to me. Right. So there were some positives that came out of that that are useful just to this day, even. So there's a way to find resource in these old things that were intense and not good at the time. All right, page two. So back to anger and healthy aggression. So the first line here really reflects this story as well. And that is, we can't always conjure up anger or any stored emotion in a hocus pocus kind of way. It's a very sophisticated term, hocus pocus. For those who don't have English as a first language, it's like magician, like boom, I make anger come out of you. It just doesn't work that way, typically, right? We need to walk on this path, get back into our physical bodies, into our sensations, into that viscera. Remember from a few training calls ago, I asked the question, where are emotions from? Where do they come from? They come from the organs. They come from the viscera. They come from the internal guts. And then we interpret them in the brain, right? And so by really getting into our viscera and into our tissues, there's more accurate feeding of information to our brains about what's happening inside. But we can't just conjure up emotions, and especially anger, in a hocus pocus way. Next line down, we must apply. We must apply the tools, self-knowledge, and educational resources we are building, which is what we talked about at the top of the call, with all the things that you're noticing, that you're doing, that you're changing, that you're integrating with, et cetera. Then trust. That's the next word. Trust and get out of the way. So the healing wisdom and the return of our true self, that authentic self, can show up. I'll read this again. Then trust, that's the first word. Trust and get out of the way so that the healing wisdom, that's the next word, and the return of our true self, that authentic self, can show up. In a parallel universe, I could have been in that training and had this feeling come up and instantly said, oh, get your posture better, Irene. You're in a crooked position, right? This is why I don't encourage, at least when you're doing neurosensory exercises with me, even if it's the most basic thing, do not sit in a position that you think is going to bring you higher to enlightenment or whatever it might be, which is how we see people sit when they meditate, when they are trying to tap into something, because there might be something procedural, there might be something somatic that needs to move through. If I had put myself into that state, I would have not found that somatic memory that was in that twisting of my spine. And it was always that direction. It was never this direction. Because the way in which the clinic was set up is you had to be on that side of the table. You see? So this is where you have to trust and get out of the way so the wisdom can come up and out. All right, next line, the power of other primal emotions that connect with anger. So enter disgust, that is the word, enter disgust, which is one of our basic primal mammalian emotions. Disgust is the emotion. So from a point of view, first line down, of evolution and survival, the primary function of disgust is to get rid of or away from a toxic substance. Toxic substance, that's the word. So this is a bit more animal kingdom biology, but for any living creature, this could be a poison, obviously for humans too, a food that's gone bad, anything environmental that is not healthy, that's the word, healthy for us and could make us sick. If I just even say this, you go into your refrigerator and you got some milk in there, doesn't matter if it's dairy. I find that rice and oat milk can go off just as bad as dairy milk. And you're not sure, but you think it's past the due date and you kind of can feel it like jiggling with curdle, but you still open the thing and smell it. It's true, yeah. You know that that chicken's gone off because it's probably been in there too long, but you still open it and smell it. It's a weird thing to confirm your suspicions, but what happens? Ugh. You guys can all try that right now, right? Ugh, like yuck, yuck, ew. That's gross. We know that this is an important thing for us to protect us from being poisoned, essentially. You'll find that as you get more in tune with yourself, your capacity to be food poisoned becomes way less. You go to that restaurant and you just taste something and you're like, something's not right about this. And you follow your impulse and you don't do it, right? I cooked some mushrooms the other day with some oil that was in our refrigerator. I'm like, something's not right about this. And it was old lard that we had used to deep fry spring rolls in. And Seth's like, it should be fine. I'm like, no, something's not right about this. And it completely went rancid. So I had to throw out the entire batch of mushrooms. Right. But I wasn't about to ingest that because the moment that smoke came into the air, I could tell it was off. It had gone rancid. So really trust those impulses. I know food waste isn't a good thing, but you don't want to make yourself sick. Right. So next line down. This is where it gets interesting. So this disgust, it can also be a human environment. That's the word, human environment. Social, parental, peers, caregivers, teachers that do not accept you or rejects you, your natural self, plus all its biological, creative, emotional, and sensory experiences and expressions. One of the things that I think occurs the most to infants, and not because the parents are trying to be mean, is when that real stinky diaper gets taken off, and there's that instant ugh that the caregiver might do. You got to be really careful with that because what that's portraying to this little being is that their bodily functions are disgusting and they're not. Right. And so that's where that is a smell that's different. Yes, it's intense, right? It's intense. And you won't die if you just breathe it in and no, I'm not going to die. And the key is that I'm here to care for this little human and clean them and make them more comfortable, right? And so, again, this is how young this can start, how young we are conditioned to have and sense that disgust from our well-meaning parents. Even the way in which a parent or a caregiver might handle us when they're cleaning us. Were they rough with you? You might not remember it cognitively, but that touch, if it's strained, if it's tense, if it's quick with talking. I remember I was in a, big poop saying that. Wow, that's a big poop. Someone, yeah, that's surprise. That's wow. Look at, yeah, your body's really working, right? You're digesting your food. It's, that kind of stuff. Very, very, that's encouraging, right? But I was in this washroom, a restroom on a highway, the little rest stops that you go to. And it was really hard for me to hear it. There was a mother in there with an infant and a toddler. And it was clear the toddler, that the toilet was probably way too high for him. And he, I think, had to have a poop. And the mother was just sighing, just like she was so pissed off that this was taking so long and frustrated. And then the little boy's like, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. Like he was so aware that she was frustrated with the fact that he wasn't able to, have his bowel movement quickly, but this is so common, right? Let's face it. And I had to get out of there pretty quickly because it just broke my heart because he was apologizing for himself. So again, she ain't, I could tell she wasn't smacking him. It was just her frustration, her energy. So there's an element, and then that's not going to help. What is that going to put in him into? That's going to put him into freeze. Or sympathetic, and his digestion, it ain't gonna let go. He's not gonna be relaxed. He's not gonna be in the good rest digest of the low tone dorsal. So I know this is a crazy one to talk about bowel movements in kids, but a lot of kids have trouble with bowel movements and they shouldn't. I mean, diet's important too, but when there's stress in the family, that is the first thing that those kiddos are gonna. The gut is your first brain, right? So someone said it puts a lot of pressure on parents. Not so much. This is just being human with your little human, right? And acknowledging all the things, when they cry, what's wrong? We pick them up. When they have a poopy diaper or they peed their pants, that's okay. Come on, let's go clean that up. The amount of shame that kids have endured in schoolrooms where they weren't allowed to go to the bathroom and they pee or poop their pants and then they're ridiculed. That's not their fault. It's because they weren't allowed to express their bodily impulses because of the structure of that system. So again, it's just about being human with those little ones. And so as adults, you might have no understanding of what happened when you were an infant. But this is where, what is one of the first things we teach? Following your impulse. You see how this is connecting in? If we had stress and trauma around going to the bathroom or however we call it, going to the toilet, we might actually be in freeze around these things, around caring for our own body parts. Women and menstruation, same thing. We certainly in the West here didn't teach women the most compassionate way to deal with their cycles. It's terrifying when I think about what was taught to us and how important it is to honor that part of our system. It's our birthright. It's how we procreate, right? So again, just be very human with yourself and gentle with yourself and tune into the things that might show up when you are letting yourself really honor your bodily, autonomic bodily responses. I cannot stress how important that is as adults as well. Yeah. So back to disgust and have a little more hot water here. We need disgust to warn us that something is toxic, but what if we can't get away from the toxicity, right? So now we're kind of flooding into less about the chemicals and less about bad milk and more about the people, the emotions, the situations that are around us that just aren't good. So this is where we enter into shame. Specifically toxic shame. Specifically toxic shame. Now, there are two kinds of shame, healthy and toxic, and they're felt in the somatic experience. That's the word. somatic experience. So this example of don't touch that, it's hot. So this one, I have an example. I don't want to get ahead of myself here. Yeah, so another example. So classic one, I know that in our culture, a toddler isn't going to be able to reach a stovetop because typically they're much higher, right? But in the olden days, the fire. Hunter-gatherer, fire, hot, right? If a child is going up to something that is dangerous, there needs to be what we would call this healthy shame. Don't touch that. It's hot. And it has to be done with enough force from the voice that it resonates and there's a little bit of a shock in that little system. That would be healthy shame. Their spine feels a bit of the trigger, right? A bit of the trigger. And then a connection of, yeah, that's really hot. Come here. You know, we're not going to go near that. Versus, and I'm going to have to act a little bit here. So this might seem a little brutal, but for some of us, this is what we were raised with. Don't touch that, you idiot. Right? But you know, the swearing, like even I say that, I don't like it. I don't like saying that because I would never talk to someone like that, right? That's how Seth was talked to, my husband, every day of his childhood from his father, right? Hence why he ended up with complex PTSD. And of course he's healed that, but that is the imprint of toxic shame. So the healthy variety, which is the next line down, the healthy variety is imprinted when connection, love, and secure attachment are present along with the demand or disciplinary action. I have an example to give you too. Someone just said, yeah, my kids grew up with, you're right, wood stoves. A lot of us grew up with fireplaces. That's a great example. Fireplaces and wood stoves where there is no barrier around them. That's a great example for infants and babies. But when they learn in that way where they're given a bit of a jolt of don't touch bad, they learn very quickly to not go there. But it has to be done in that way. If it's done like this, so this is the other part. Oh, honey, honey, don't touch that. You're going to hurt yourself. Did you hear that? Did that come through the microphone? That is not going to teach healthy shame. And I think there's been a lot of swing to that in recent generations, right? So the post-World War II and I kiddos got the stern almost too much. And then those kids grew up, they had the trauma from those parents, and then they swung the other way and let everything go and no need to teach any discipline. And now we're in the repercussions of that. And so now it's like, okay, we need to teach healthy shame. We don't want to ridicule and cause fear in these children, but they need to learn right from wrong. Very important. Yeah, electric fences and farms. I've heard some horror stories around that. So that's another one that is a weird one. I've had friends who have told me that their parents made it a game. They would shock their kids for fun. I was like, really? That's really bad. But it was like, hey, feel this electricity. Like the you know, you're just so used to it as an adult. You think it's fun because it's like this little shock. It's like, no, that is not good for a human system to be electrified, right? But again, if the kid doesn't know, they just think it's a fun game, right? So again, there's an example of I've had those traumas come out of people not realizing that's not right to be electrocuted by your parents for fun. Not cool. So my cutting bread example. So this is an interesting example. So I was old enough to cut bread. Don't know how old. Not too old because we had this very low table in our kitchen that was lower than the kitchen table. Like it pulled out. And I must have been cutting bread. I know I was with the knife facing my face. That's right. So I'm cutting this piece of bread. And the knife toward my face, and my dad was eating his breakfast, and big baritone. And my dad has never screamed at me, ever. I've never been hit, never been screamed at. My parents did that right. But this big, Irene, look at what you're doing. He was very like he I was young, old enough to be able to learn something. Because you're gonna hurt yourself if you keep the knife that way. Turn the knife around and then start cutting, right? And it shocked me. I'm like, oh, right. And then I was fine. And to this day, if I'm rushed or not really aware, which happens, I will find myself handling my knives because I chop a lot in a clumsy, clunky way. And I will hear him in my body. So the imprint of that healthy shame has been useful. Right? It makes me very careful in other ways with other things when I'm picking up things, like, am I going to slip? Right? And so don't underestimate how powerful a teaching moment can be like that for a child when it's done with connection and care. And it needs to get in the somatic physiology. If it doesn't, it won't stick. So a lot of times parents will say, but I try, I discipline, and it just doesn't shift. And my sense is it's not coming in that strong, healthy shame way. Now here's the clincher. When you are still dealing with your unresolved toxic shame, it will be very hard to emit this in a way that is genuine. And Seth and I have talked about that, and maybe he's talked about that in some of his Q&A calls. Our biggest fights were around him raising his kiddo and me seeing the damage because this kid wasn't given any healthy shame, right? And but he couldn't bring himself to do it because it hurt too much. He was still working on his stuff, right? So nothing's perfect, right? Nothing's perfect, but that shows you if it's tough to admit that, know that that's normal. And the key is how can you work on it and work on it so that you get comfortable being able to admit those things. Now, I know for some of you who have adult children, you might be going, oh my God, I totally screwed up. And if they're still in your life and you have a decent relationship, apologize. Be the good parent. Apologize. That's what Seth did with his adult son. And just say, you know, I didn't know, and this is why. You can't do this with a teenager, though. They're too young. You got to wait till they're adults, or at least old enough to understand, right? So you do not say this to an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old. You wait till they're old enough and they're their own adult person to have an adult to adult conversation, and say, you know, I just didn't know, and there's no excuse other than I was working with my own stuff, but I didn't even know I was working with my own stuff, right? So again, that is case by case basis, but we can't underestimate how important this healthy shame is. And we know this in animals. Like when you have a dog, you have to, this is the other thing I learned from the animal hospital, you have to have a strong alpha male voice. I see it in the park all the time. These owners of dogs that cannot keep their animals contained, and you hear them shouting, and it's this little wimpy, come back, come back. It's not going to work. You need to be the alpha male, or they won't listen. And so you see it in other situations around when you start to look at it. And you can also apply this to yourself. Sometimes you need to give yourself a bit of a pep talk. Whew, we really need to get this house cleaned up, right? And it's not about shaming yourself in a healthy way, but sometimes that little bit of alpha male energy is important to get stuff done. It's that healthy aggression, right? Not in a way that's toxic. Again, go back. It's not about it being toxic. It's how can that be aggressive in a healthy way, moving forward way. All right, page three. Now, I also know that this might be bringing up a lot of stuff from your own world, maybe your own upbringing, how you maybe raised your kiddos. just know that this will sink and this will start to make sense as time goes on. Someone just mentioned Brené Brown. It's bound to happen. We don't agree with her. I think she's great for a lot of other things. She's fun to listen to, but she will often say guilt. And I think I have a piece on guilt too. Guilt is more advanced. A two-year-old can't feel guilty for touching the stove, right? They just get hurt or they hear the scream. So shame from this healthy perspective is something you have to feel in the body. When it's toxic, you feel it, but then you feel shitty about yourself because there's no connection. And the way that the energy comes out of usually the adult, it's hurtful, right? Guilt is, oh man, I just broke my husband's favorite mug. Shit. Like, I feel terrible. That's guilt. But it's not shame, right? So again, people will say they'll say shame is I am bad and guilt is I've done something bad. That's too simplistic for this case. There really needs to be that healthy shame in that early upbringing. And what occurs, back to my bread example, is when it's done really accurately at the beginning, it doesn't keep happening. You don't have to keep saying to the kid, cut the different way with the knife. Cut. It just gets instilled because it's somatic and it's a true learning piece, right? Okay. Page three. I already mentioned this. So this is review from the story. So the toxic variety can be imprinted via the tone of the voice from the other, the ridiculing, the violent behavior, or any other abusive action that invokes a sense of fear, a need to protect and or shut down. When it's healthy, there is no shutdown. There might be a little collapse, but that collapse is rectified because usually the older adult doesn't exit. They stay with you. They keep that ventral vagal going with you, right? So this is, in some ways, this healthy shame piece is like the polyvagal system in full force working. You're fearing a little bit of that fear, a little bit of startle, a little sympathetic, but then, oh, But mom's still here. She still clearly loves me, even though she just really raised her voice in a harsh way. That's confusing, but okay, I'm still here. Oh, not supposed to touch the hot stove. Got it. Right? And so there's a lot of interplay happening in that. Animals in the wild do it. Mama bears, that they will literally grab their cubs by the scruff of the neck if they're going somewhere dangerous. That's their way of teaching. That is dangerous. Don't go over the cliff, right? That kind of thing. Next line. The affect, so the emotional quality, the word is affect, spelled with an A. A-F-F-E-T. A-F-F-E-C-T. Sorry, E-C-T. The affect of disgust is very similar to the affect of anger. Remember when we did the sour milk experiment? Try that again with your face. What do you do with your teeth? Yeah. See, Robert. Yeah. Yeah. It's like it's opening the mouth. It's making that. It's almost the beginning of a snarl. So again, these emotions, they do bleed into each other in an interesting way. Next line, when we are able to powerfully express our anger, we reclaim, that's the word, our life force energy. This can lead to the completion, that's the next word, completion. This can lead to the completion of self-protective responses, stored procedural memories, that would have wanted to happen to protect us from the toxicity, toxic shame, the abuse, the person, but did not. So when you're two and you get toxic shame dosed out to you, it is not accurate for your biology to say, let's get angry at mom and hit her. Two-year-olds, not well, they might try. That's the acting out, the tantrum. That's the, I'm going to go and be do something else, right? I'm going to, the kid, the teenager at school that starts bullying and being really terrible. What kind of speak is being given to him at home by his mom that's telling, you know, all this ridicule, all this toxic shame at home, and they can't get it out to the parents because they'll get more of it. So what do? They go join a gang. They go break into cars. They go do whatever to be really mean to their peers, right? It's a way to express that anger and that rage that something is happening to me that isn't good. So the more we can work with our healthy life force energy, the more we have the capacity to start to be with some of the deep, deep stored survival stress procedural memories that we would have stored as a result of having toxic shame dosed out to us. Now, I can't say this for sure, but my sense is it helps to have a bit more capacity, a little bit of feistiness in us in order to start to work with the deep imprints of toxic shame. I would not, this is why we don't do this call until now in the training. Yeah, when there's a bit more resource, a bit more capacity on board, or a lot more resource, a lot more capacity on board. All right, there's a great quote here. Before I read it, I'm going to have a bit more water. This is from a gentleman by the name of John Bradshaw. He's passed, he's a psychotherapist. If you look him up, his name is on the handout on Google. He has some wonderful old PBS videos from the 80s. The dress is great. Talking about shame. And this is not, this is from his book. So he also wrote a book called Healing the Shame That Binds You. And a lot of the information and teachings that Peter Levine and our senior mentors get around toxic shame and healthy shame come from John Bradshaw, FYI. So my mentors aren't just making this up. This has been known for a little bit. So this is taken out of a portion of his book. So this ties in the anger and the shame piece, and obviously read along with me. For example, if you were never allowed to express anger in your family, your anger becomes an alienated part of yourself. You experience toxic shame when you feel angry. You experience toxic shame when you feel angry. How many of us might feel a bit of shame when they're getting a little angry? See how that connects to when you were little and wee? Little. This part of you must be disowned or severed. There is no way to get rid of your emotional power of anger. Anger is self-preserving and self-protective. I'm going to say that again. There is no way to get rid of your emotional power of anger. Anger is self-preserving and self-protective energy. Without this energy, you become a doormat and a people pleaser. Bold, I know, but that's true. As your feelings, needs, and drives are bound by toxic shame, more and more of you is alienated. When shame has been completely internalized, nothing about you is okay. You have the sense of being a failure. There is no way you can share your inner self because you are an object of contempt to yourself. Powerful. When you are contemptible to yourself, you are no longer in you. To feel shame is to feel exposed in a diminished way. When you are an object to yourself, you turn your eyes inwards, watching and scrutinizing every minute detail of behavior. Anyone do this? Anyone? Yes. Sound familiar? Got to kind of call yourself out, right? In a way that's oddly humorous, like, whoa, yeah, that is me. Crazy. He's talking to me, right? This internal critical observation is excruciating. It generates tormenting self-consciousness that describes as creating a binding and paralyzing effect upon the self. This paralyzing internal monitoring causes withdrawal, passivity, and inaction. What's withdrawal, passivity, and inaction? Freeze. It's collapse. It's protective. What is the scrutinizing of every minute detail? The critical internal observation is excruciating. Intense mental anxiety. The kid that wants to be angry and can't is having a hard time. That's a lot of dynamite to keep inside, right? So great book. Intense book, but very, very, that's just one piece of this book. You know, it is written pretty much for the general person. But it really, you know, he really got it. And the videos are quite good because he's also a very good orator. He's good at speaking. So look, they're online. So that is an example of how the shame, that life force energy, the internalization, hello, mental health problems. Yeah. Hello, having crazy thoughts because we can't express, like it's all trying to be processed inside, but it has to get out. The system has to express these stored things that never got to express. Yeah, healing the shame that binds you. It's written on the handout under the paragraph, the long paragraph I read. So number four, page four. So this is more Bradshaw, not quite done yet. So this is where I have the guilt piece. Before we go to the next piece, just take a second to orient a little bit. Let's just make sure you're all here at 12:11 Pacific time on May 2nd, the year 2023. It's not 1975 or 1950. You're not in your parents' room anymore. You're here. And yet your somatic system is remembering all of this stuff, right? So an important note on guilt. The experience of guilt is more advanced. John Bradshaw, the guy that I just quoted, terms guilt moral shame. So that's his way of talking about it, moral shame, morality. It's the example I gave. I just broke my husband's favorite mug. God, I feel terrible. Moral, like that was bad. Shouldn't have done that. I should have been more careful. Right. Now, if someone is dealing with a lot of stored toxic shame from their childhood, what do you think would happen when they break that mug? Total internalization. Oh my God, I'm such an idiot, I'm so clumsy, right? That dialogue, not good, because it's something that occurred on the outside, but when there is that imprint of toxic shame, the person will literally beat themselves up internally. And we do know that some people will also beat themselves up physically. They will self-harm. Right? Self-harm is another way to try to get these demons out, right? So moral shame, guilt. Guilt is important. Someone does something bad, that's really bad. They need to know that that's bad. I'm thinking more adults, right? Crime. But we know that most crime is committed because people are traumatized and dysregulated. So then you go back to that. It's like, why are they trying to express this violence? Probably because they were violated when they were young and they haven't done the healing, right? It's pretty cut and dry. When you talk to people who are in prisons and you find out their history and it's riddled with trauma, so much trauma. Next line is another quote, final quote from Bradshaw. The rules and limits children have experienced from their caregivers or their environment are internalized and become an inner voice that guides and limits behavior. I'll say that again, it's a big sentence. The rules and limits children have experienced from their caregivers or from the environment are internalized and become an inner voice that guides and limits behavior. Guilt is the guardian of conscience, and children begin to form their conscience during the preschool period. So I say that because around the age of five, that's when there's a shift in awareness and consciousness of the human. Before that, it's like pre-verbal. Not as much cognition is on board. I'm going to share this. This is a tricky one to hear, but it was a piece of research I heard a while ago. I can't give you the reference because this was from years and years ago. But I remember a psychologist saying that if a child loses a parent under the age of five, they're fine. They'll feel the loss. They know something's not there, but they don't consciously get it. At the age of five, there have been accounts of children committing suicide when they lose their mother. I get tingles thinking of that. That's because they understand what really just happened. And for whatever reason, they didn't have the support. They didn't have the connection. You're going to be fine. We're here for you. Now, of course, there's some kids that are fine. Their mother dies or their father dies and they're left with the abusive parent or they're put in foster care. That's not good. That's not good, right? Could tear up just thinking about it. But that shows, that's what he means here. I wanted to give you an example. This isn't just about, I shouldn't steal my brother's toy. This is like serious. You understand the consequences of life much more at that age. Much more at that age. Yeah, some kids live, but they don't heal that trauma. Yeah, well, that's why we're here, right? You know, how many of us have had really harrowing things occur when we were five or under the age of five? But then it comes out, as you've learned, in illness, chronic illness, migraine, headache, all the things that occur. Final page here. Dissolving the imprints from a somatic perspective. So just if we just pause and come away from the idea of disgust, everything that we're doing in SBSM is in service to healing this system that may have been toxically shamed. So sometimes it'll be asked, what is one specific exercise, Irene, for toxic shame? And I say, you're doing it. Everything you're doing, building capacity, understanding your collapse mechanisms, understanding your fight flight. Can you feel when your body starts to shrink when you spill and break the glass on the ground? Listen to that. It's like the example of me stubbing my toe, right? You're less likely to ridicule yourself for that, maybe, but if you break something, if you do something that's going to impact someone else, you might feel that deep pitted shame that's toxic, or that memory of it, I should say. And then that's where you have to put your thinking cap on and be like, snap out of it. Like Cher said to Nicolas Cage in the movie Moonlight, snap out of it, you know, get out of that. Bring yourself out of that collapse. Back to the first quote that Peter had. You know, we're trying to have the antidote to trauma. So you feel yourself driving into that. Okay, find your potent posture. Are you breathing? Chances are you're not breathing deep. You've stopped your breath because you're waiting for someone to smack you as a 45-year-old adult in your own home with no parent. But there's something in you that's waiting for that screaming voice to ridicule you because you've just broken a glass on the kitchen floor. I watched this with my first husband, actually. I was married before Seth for 8 years. He had a lot of toxic shame growing up. I didn't realize what it was because I didn't know this information. But if he burned something cooking, I thought that the world was ending. He screamed at himself. He would never scream at me, but he would scream at himself. He would get so frustrated. I'd be like, he just burnt some toast. What's the big deal? Make another piece. It's not like we're impoverished. But I didn't. And so this was the part of our fights because I didn't understand. It's like, it's just toast. And he just wouldn't, but he didn't even know. He didn't know why he was having these reactions to not getting it. He would ridicule himself. And so that's what was going on. So in those moments, like, how can you come into your body, orient, do the things that you know are your resources so that you can come out of that fog of ridiculing and internalizing? It's just a broken glass. If anything, just clean it up, right? Don't get cut, that kind of thing. Make it very practical, pragmatic. Nothing wrong with, shit, that was my favorite glass. Okay, that's okay. It's just a glass, right? How can you be very neutral with that? And that's really what a parent wouldn't say shit, but they might say it in their head. Like, let's just clean it up. That's okay. We can get another one. Not a big deal, right? What's that saying? Don't cry over spilt milk. I have no idea where that saying comes from. Now I want to look it up, but it's true. Why bother crying over spilt milk? So dissolving the imprints from a somatic perspective. So disgust is the gateway emotion to healing toxic shame. We'll move through this and then I'll example it a little bit. So disgust is the gateway or a gateway emotion to healing shame, toxic shame. That should say toxic shame. Put a little thing in there, toxic shame. When a person can access the quality and feeling of disgust, they start to heal the imprints. Imprints is the word of toxic shame. Toxic shame is often associated with lifelong collapse, shutdown, poor posture, difficulty with healthy social environment, varied vocal prosody. That's the ability for your voice to go high, but also have it be a little lower when you're talking to a baby, right? You're not going to talk to a baby in a big, high voice because that's going to scare them. So we need to have this, what's called prosody, to be healthy. Chronic illness, lack of emotional resiliency. So all this lifelong collapse is connected to many of these things. So when we begin to move these emotions, that's the word, when we begin to move these emotions and bring more energy and potency into our body, via the neurosensory exercises, other somatic practices, good therapy, et cetera. We'll begin to move these emotions and bring more energy and potency into our body and can stay oriented. Oriented is the word, to the present moment, in the moment, here we are now, alongside more accurate interoception, we start to move out these imprints and heal. We start to move out these imprints and heal. And I don't have this written down, and it takes time. Write that in bold fluorescent yellow. And it takes time. I think that because we have more understanding now of what this toxic shame is, and we have this perspective of the somatic physiology and what it does to the nervous system, and then how the nervous system is connected to the posture, and it's connected to the digestion, it's connected to the social engagement. All of you have such a great awareness of all these pieces that you can monitor and work with. So it's not about just sitting in the deep depths of disgust. So the disgust piece, how do I describe this? It's something that tends to start coming up naturally when there is lots of imprints of toxic shame. Now, it might come up in that your appetite is off for a couple of days or a week. It doesn't mean you're not eating, but like heavy smells. You're like, I just can't. I just need to like have dry toast and butter with maybe a little bit of whatever, like really plain, because scents might throw you off. And there's this wanting to dry heave. So that nauseating feeling that some people might feel, if anybody's been feeling a little extra nausea throughout SPSM, oddly, that's a good sign. It's a sign that you're starting to feel more of your viscera. Doesn't mean you're not going to have a spicy burrito later on, but you might need to just be a bit more plain as this digestive system and as your sensory systems reshift, because you're taking off a layer of freeze. Just 2 days ago, I got in my car, and you know the little ticker that does the signaling right and left? It was so loud. I'm like knocking on my car, like, what's wrong with my car? Something's not right here. And I've been still going through my layers of freeze, and it was fine yesterday, but 2 days ago, it was so loud. I'm like, this has to be my system just being more perceptive to something. And I know it is because I've been working on some tension in my ear, fascial tension in my ear. So something's popped open. So I share that because you might feel a little nausea, or maybe you're like, ugh, I can't taste that. I can't eat that right now. Right. Or maybe you have a craving for something different. Really listen to those impulses. The other thing that might occur is as you're doing a neurosensory exercise, you might all of a sudden feel the desire to vomit, but there's no food in your stomach. So when that happens, if it's comfortable and you feel you have the capacity, allow yourself to retch. Retch is, it's hard. It's really hard to mimic retching when it's not happening, because it's a convulsion. It's a spasm of the stomach, but it is the system purging essentially emotional energy. It will feel like you're actually vomiting, but you're not going to. And so again, just like if you're expressing anger, just like if you're expressing any emotion, in this case, it is disgust. Disgust isn't just, you just don't sit here and go, oh yeah, I'm feeling disgust. Mm-hmm. Yep. Not like that. It's visceral, but you need capacity, because you're going to go through, if you've ever vomited, I'm sure all of us have at some point, it's a full body response. It's like a sneeze. It goes right to the core. And so this is where, again, capacity, you don't want your system to come out of that and then go into shutdown. You might feel a little tired afterwards, but it'll actually feel better. Right? So it's the disgust for what occurred to you. It's the disgust for what occurred to you, not disgust for yourself. It's like you're purging the toxins from the energetic and the abuse that may have happened. So yeah, disgust is a big one. And it is something that you need to know about, but it isn't something that you practice. It's not like practicing the Vu and the Vu-Ah, which is helping prime anger. I'm not going to ask you to pretend to dry heave and retch, right? So don't do that. Just know that it's there. And if and when it may or may not show up, let that come through. I was not toxically shamed as a kiddo, but there was a few moments in my healing journey where I had intense nausea, and I found myself dry heaving. No, no, why? Maybe there's something I don't know about, you know, but again, let that come out. Someone said, is intense vertigo common when doing this work? It definitely can be, because that inner ear is being influenced by your autonomic nervous system. It's being influenced by your vagus nerve. But there's so many reasons why we can get vertigo. It can be the pressure in the atmosphere. It could be old head trauma. But it also could be the system coming back online. So just, you don't want it to, you don't want vertigo to continue for like days on end. If vertigo comes in, it might be just for a couple moments or a minute, and then you want it to shift. And that is where ground, here I am, go back to your basics over and over and over again. 100%. Yeah, resistance and procrastination is part of freeze. Yep. So, page five, go to page five. We're gonna do something little. We got a couple, we're at the hour, half hour, but we'll just end with a little bit of movement. I will answer the someone said, does this work ever end? Maybe. Being really honest, it gets less intense. And I get why this is frustrating. Someone said, I feel frustrated lately at how much I'm living in the past. So that's a good clue. If you keep popping into the past, then it's going to take a lot longer. You've got to pull yourself here. Doesn't mean you might not have memories, but you got to keep pulling yourself, pulling yourself. Having that image of that stage, where there's an act on stage that's really terrible, and they pull that thing out and they pull the person off stage. Like if you find yourself going onto this stage that's reenacting the past, you got to pull yourself out. You got to pull yourself off that stage of the past and be like, these are my feet right now today. These are my hands. Go back to the lessons. Joints, containment, orienting, VU, whatever it is, your resources, hot cup of tea, you got to bring yourself back into the moment. It's not about ignoring the past. It's not about not, it's not about letting the past go. That would be amnesia. You don't want brain damage, but you want the past to be less potent. So you got to bring it in. You got to hook yourself back in into here, not back there. Yeah, give the past the hook. That's a quotable. Good one. So let's move a little. Just stand up, everyone, if it's comfortable. If before we completely end, just stand up for a sec. Because this content is can be quite intense. Someone said they were nauseous the whole training call. Give yourself some time after this. Go do something really silly and fun and not serious. You were finding yourself a bit nauseous throughout the whole call. So just move a little bit, just follow your impulse. Walk, run, stomp, swing your arms, whatever feels right. Someone just said when unnecessary memories come up, I tell myself, don't go there, and I come back to the now. Wonderful. And then I would even add, just come back to now. Because the moment we say don't, there's like an influence of negativity. Like, it's okay. You went there. Just come back. So with that said, come back and just bring your hand to your chest and just say me. You can do it gently, or if there's a need to really me. Like Matthew McConaughey in that movie where he's like hitting his chest and doing the sounds, just like, here I am, me. Maybe it feels better to touch your pelvis, or maybe it feels better to give your thighs a little slap, or maybe your feet, or maybe you need to touch your head. It doesn't matter. Just let something come in with this verbiage and word, me. This is me. And maybe even orient and be like, I'm here right now. And another piece that's on the handout, and I'll explain it, is you. So there's lots of yous. I see Leah, you. I see Sarah, you. I see Louise, you. I see Robert, you. There's all these people, Michael, Patricia, Bonnie, Lisa, on my screen at least. So let yourself either see the gallery or see maybe you have a dog or a cat or a plant. just look at something outside of you and be like, you. So you're differentiating between me and you. Just to make that very distinct, the boundary between you and outside of you. I wanted to end with that because when we're in these soups of toxic shame from our early time, the boundaries get foggy. I mean, all trauma makes it foggy. Yeah, to go back to that first quote from Peter, the antidote of trauma is putting ourselves into other situations that don't bring in helplessness and collapse. So being able to just voice, this is me, that's outside, this is you, we're here, super important. All right, everyone, lot covered today. The next two training calls, we're going to dive into more Feldenkraisian learning. So it'll be a little lighter, fun, a little less intense. I know that the toxic shame piece is a sticky, tricky one. So if you know that this is something that you're working with, just be very gentle on yourself. The gentler you are on yourself, the easier it will be to navigate the stickiness of this quality, right? So don't push it. Just keep going back to the lessons. Just keep going back to the neurosensory exercises. Keep going back to orienting. Just don't underestimate the power of repeating the basic stuff over and over and over again. It's a language, right? It's not about mastering this trauma release stuff. It's about learning the language of your system and restoring it back to safety and the present moment. All right. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Leah. Thanks, Bonnie. To all the alum and newbies and all those listening to the recording, we will see you next week. Bye for now.